Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. With me is Feudal Fromagière and star of this week's TLS. Yes, she's in this week's TLS as well as editing it, Thea Lena Dootsey. Thea, hello.
Hello.
Are you feeling festive?
No.
No, no, God, no. I despair.
Give me some
Christmas.
Time. I was in, at least another 2.5 weeks.
I can't. Christmas music is. I was in Starbucks the other day and I was just saying to the people there, they have to stand there for like 3.5 weeks with awful Christmas music.
Can you think of any good Christmas songs?
No.
I can only think of one.
You're going to say the.
The Pogues and Kirsty McCall.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it.
That's the only one, though, isn't
that
it?
Is the only one.
This woman said she liked Mariah Carey. I hate that song so much. What's the song called? The Mariah Carey song?
Well, she did a whole Christmas album.
Oh, Matt, the producer, just leapt in there. We talk about literature, high-end literature, and he's as silent as the grave. I mentioned Mariah Carey once, and it just pings in my ear. All I want for Christmas. A fact about that. Would you like to hear the fact about it? She earns $500,000 every year from the royalties for that just in Christmas time.
God.
So that was that paid off for her, didn't it?
I think it did, yeah.
There you go, high-low culture, a bit of everything here. Remember, if you want to subscribe to the TLS, there's no Mariah Carey this week, but, you know, don't rule it out. Yeah, exactly. Google TLS subscriptions and type POD1 in the offer code section. You can get 6 issues for £6. Do review us on iTunes too. And this week, yes, my very special, super high-profile guest is Thea. She's written a wonderful lead piece on the collected writings of Elizabeth Hardwick, a woman perhaps wrongly known as the wife of poet Robert Lowell, but also a critic, essayist and novelist in her own right. Thea will tell us all about her. Historian Susanna Lipscomb will be talking about her fascinating research into the records of French consistory courts, in which moral crimes were addressed using the punishment of public shaming. And how healthy is the poetry pamphlet business? One of our poetry critics, Leif Arbuthnot, will be in the studio to tell us about the state of the game, having been a judge on the Michael Marks Awards, which celebrates this peculiar area of literary publishing. Elizabeth Hardwick died 10 years ago this month, leaving a legacy perhaps most firmly in the world of literary criticism and book reviewing. In 1959, she had disconcerted an entire industry with her piece The Decline of Book Reviewing, in which she scorned the cosiness of the literary establishment. She said this: "Sweet, bland commendations fall everywhere upon the scene. A universal, if somewhat lobotomised, accommodation reigns. A book is born into a puddle of treacle. The brine of hostile criticism is only a memory." See, I'm rather fond of the well-written hatchet job, that salty tang of the appalled review, the genuine storm of merited disapproval. So I find myself already warming to Elizabeth Hardwick. Thea, of course, is not so mean-spirited when she reviews Hardwick's collected essays. While Hardwick may be, as Daryl Pinkney avers, a writer's writer, she was always far more outwardly inclined than all that, interested in how we tell the stories of our lives and the lives of others. She had an authorial presence that was, in the end, wonderfully embracing. As Thea puts it, an I that becomes them becomes us. So Thea, hooray! You can tell us more.
Hello.
Hello. Does this feel awkward?
It does. I feel like I should have gone out for an outfit change or something.
Yeah, exactly. You should have put another hat on. But let's talk about Elizabeth Hardwick. What is she known for, and what should she be known for?
She was. Well, I mean, let's start with where she was born and sort of how she came to be what she was. I suppose she was born in 1916 in Kentucky. Her father was in the plumbing trade. Her mother was very often pregnant. And then she decided that she wanted to go to New York to make something of herself. So she went to Columbia and she started studying the metaphysical poets because that was, as she put it, the trendy thing to do. And then she dropped out of that. She thought that that was all about scholarship, and scholarship was not about making oneself interesting, about communicating in an interesting way and so on. And so then she started writing novels. And it was when she wrote her first novel, The Ghostly Lover, in 1945, that she came to the attention of Philip Rav. Now, Philip Rav was the founding editor of Partisan Review. And so what followed was a meeting with him, during which he said, you know, I like what you do, write for me. And so she started to review novels and write other criticism. And everything followed from there, really.
She made a name. And you could make a living doing that,
you could make a living doing that.
Unlike now.
Exactly. You could make a living doing that. And she did a lot of it. She made a name for herself writing these, you know, quick and witty and insightful and sharp pieces. She fell in with the right coterie, became friends with Mary McCarthy, Hannah Arendt, later Robert Lowell, Edmund Wilson, and all of that set. So she was one of the bright young things. And as I said, went on to found the NYRB and continued to do all of that. As a novelist, she's not very well known.
Is she a good novelist? Do you like her novels?
She only wrote three, and they were very, very spaced out. So the first one was The Ghostly Lover in 1945, and then A Simple Truth came in 55, followed by Sleepless Nights in 79. So that gives you a sense of the difficulty for her. Writing fiction was hard. She really struggled with it. And you see that in interviews. There's the interview in the Paris Review where she basically says the first line of the novel and every line after that is difficult. She doesn't know if she's going to pull it off.
Because it's very rare to find someone who's who's firstly a critic who can then write a novel. I mean, James Woods being a modern example, yeah. You know, he's got a novel coming out, I think, but has never really managed to become a novelist.
Yeah.
Because he's so well regarded as a critic, and if she spends her life skewering the fiction of others, is that the reason novel writing was so hard, do you think?
I don't think so. I don't think it was so much that. I think it was more a case of not knowing where she stood in the fiction. She knew where she stood when she was writing about other people's writing, but she found her life's work was to find a way of placing the I in whatever writing she was doing, the self in whatever writing she was doing, without it intruding or becoming specifically about the person who's writing the piece. The whole thing is just this really delicate and sophisticated balance. And that, you know, that goes from her fiction. She wrote a lot of short stories as well. And progressively you can see her kind of owning herself and owning her critical voice. I hate that expression, but that's what you see across her oeuvre.
How much should Robert Lowell feature in this story? I was looking at the Independence obituary when it was a newspaper rather than a clickbait site of tat, which it is now. But its headline was this: writer, co-founder of the New York Review of Books and long-suffering wife of Robert Lowell. Is that a fair writer first, founder of the NYRB and long-suffering wife of Robert Lowell third? Is that a fair summary, do you think, of...
Well, I mean, they've missed the kind of the critical heart out of it in a way. I mean, writer as an epithet is sort of throwaway. Everyone's a writer. It doesn't really tell us how important a writer she was, and she is, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more, she is an incredibly important writer. The place of Robert Lowell is, yeah, of course he's got to be there. It's essential, and he played a very important role in making her write the way she wrote and what she chose to write about, in part because, you know, he was the poet who brought us confessional poetry in its big form. You know, that's
he used lines of her letters without consent in
Dolphin, and went on to win a Pulitzer Prize for it.
and how did she feel about that?
Very, very hurt. And so that was following their separation in 1970. So I should say, I mean, Robert Lowell, yes, important because of the confessional aspect and the fact that, yes, he did take her letters and use them in his poetry, changing them as well, not just taking them verbatim, which was almost the bigger betrayal there. But he also drove her to focus on the relationships between writers and couples and all of that sort of stuff. So that's what made her interested, I think, in literary couples through history. So the way she writes about Thomas and Jane Carlyle,
yep.
And all of this. But
there's a great line about that she wrote. This is about Thomas and Jane Carlyle. They were, first of all, persons who drifted in and out of unhappiness, often within the course of a single day. And people say that's possibly an autobiographical remark.
I mean, that essay there is generally taken as one of her more autobiographical pieces. And, you know, she said herself, you can't write about the lives of others without leaving a trace of yourself. And the fact of Robert Lowell's existence, of his marriage to her, the result of that was that, yes, they went through cycles. Every year, roughly before Christmas, he would have a manic episode, I think usually immediately preceding or following infidelity. He would usually be sectioned. She would stand by him, take him reading when he was in the ward.
So it wasn't a happy... Do you think it was a happy life?
On her account, it was. I mean, that's what I say in my piece, is that it's a relationship that one, as an outsider, can't possibly understand. They had their own system, whatever that was.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact you would think, okay, so someone has taken letters that I wrote to him after he left me for the arms of another younger woman, and he has twisted them, he's altered them, and he's published them as poetry, as part of his poems that have gone on to win a Pulitzer Prize. You'd think it would be pretty hard to come back from
that. It's a betrayal upon a betrayal, really.
It's a betrayal upon a betrayal, and yet... they got back together. Almost, in that she agreed to take him back, and then he died in the taxi on his way from the airport back to the flat that they had once shared and where she still lived. So he died in the cab outside, apparently clutching a portrait of his third wife, Lady Caroline Blackwood, which would have been worth some money because of who she was. And it's a fascinating thing, and everybody told Lowell at the time, Adrienne Rich, who was a mutual friend, the poet, and Elizabeth Bishop, again a mutual friend, but much more Lowell's than Hardwick's, said, art just isn't worth that much. And, you know, in part that was because she'd already gone off confessional poetry anyway and just found it annoying that people were writing about, you know, their mothers and their fathers and their sex lives all the time. But yes... But what I don't want to do is talk too much about Lowell and all of that.
No, because the bits are fascinating with that story. But I mean, I was struck by... I'd never read The Decline of Book Reviewing. So let's talk about her writing, because I read the essay after you mentioned it. How did that go down? And did that actually make a change? Because she helps to found the NYRB soon after that, really. It's sort of 2 or 3 years after that. This Decline of Book Reviewing is basically saying it's filled with log rolling and treacly nonsense. It needs to be more... intellectually credible.
Mm-hmm.
Did she change anything?
She absolutely did. I mean, yeah, so she wrote The Decline of Book Reviewing in 1959, and that was published in Harper's, where Robert Silvers was then an editor. And, you know, that was a rejection of, as you said, the kind of the anodyne, treacly book review that didn't make anyone feel anything, really. It was just basically summaries, maybe an odd, you know, little quote to enliven things, something that will be familiar to most readers these days of kind of the, you know, weekend supplements.
But not the TLS.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And, you know, that is in part her legacy. So 1963, there was the newspaper strike, in the printer strike in New York, and Silvers, Hardwick and Barbara Epstein got together and said, look, well, you know, we've been saying for years that kind of naff little review that doesn't really tell anyone anything or excite anyone or make anyone really realise that books are vitally important and intellectual discussion is vitally important because it is so enslaved to adverts from publishers. Now's our chance to do something about it. And so then they set up the NYRB and everything follows, really. And so that became a natural place for Hardwick because it was almost like the dream relationship, really, between an editor and a writer. Her friends, editors, Robert Silvers, could say, why don't you write a piece on such and such a thing? Or she could say to him, I've got this kernel of an idea, and he'll say, go away and do it. And then it gave her a freedom to write. And
did she use that platform? What did she use that platform for? I mean, did she bring attention upon up-and-coming writers? Did she promote women's writing? Did she take that platform and do something with it?
She did. She promoted women's writing, but she also made vast pronouncements about what fiction was, where it was up to, what it was doing. So one famous one about contemporary fiction took as its basis Renata Adler's Speedboat, and kind of took that as, you know, a jumping off point to make all of these statements about what contemporary fiction was and should be, and how it should challenge the form, and, you know, it shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't try to emulate writers who had gone before. It doesn't have to have plot, it just needs to have strength of character and voice and all of these things, which she then put into practice in her own writing, whether fiction or non-fiction. And, you know, with Hardwick, the terms fiction and non-fiction are sort of,
yeah,
they don't really stick anyway, because they do bleed into each other. And that's not to say anything as trite as life is art and art is life, but more to say that one is a tool that can be used to excavate the other.
We need more of that sort of writing in the paper. I'm always struck that you can always review a book too much, I feel. You know, in that's not just a review of a book. She's then said, taken that to then say something else.
Mm.
And there's probably not enough of that now, is there?
No, I mean, it's that sense of, I don't really care about the plot. I want to know how it feels and how it will make me feel and what it does.
Or what its context is, or what it says about something else.
What its context is. Yeah. Why is it important? Yeah. Why should anyone, out of all the books that are published, why should anyone read this? And Hardwick at her best is actually, I think, a reviewer. If we flip the page in this week's paper, there's a piece by Louis Amos of Cynthia Ozick. And she was very condescending of reviews. She didn't really think reviews were very important, but, you know, to that, all you have to do is say, hello, Elizabeth Hardwick. I mean, she would take a review, you know, here, review this life of Edmund Wilson or whoever. And she would use that as a reason to really dig in and think about what matters when you're writing a life or a novel or anything, really.
And when did you get into her? Because talking to you now, you clearly have been utterly immersed in her stuff.
Yeah.
When did that happen, and why did that happen?
I think at university, actually. And I can't remember exactly what the path was, but it probably went something like Wolf, something else, Elizabeth Hardwick.
Really?
She wrote an essay, in fact, about Wolf. She wrote a very funny essay about the Bloomsbury set, in which she basically, I can't remember the line, and I'm so sorry. She said something like, you know, if I have to hear another name, another line about Adeline at the table in the corner sitting, yeah, blah, 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 I'll scream. So I think that's probably how I got to her.
And if people haven't heard of her, and you can tell one book to go and read, would you say, finally, go and read these new collected essays, or would you say go and read Seduction and Betrayal, or would you say go read a novel first? What would you say? You've got one title.
I would say start with Seduction and Betrayal, actually, because that was the book that most excited me. And it's flawed. I mean, that's the great thing about Hardwick, is that she's absolutely brilliant, but there's always room to pick up on a little flaw. And it's not necessarily a flaw in the way that she did it, but it's something to disagree with.
Yeah.
She's like your brilliant friend who, you know, sits there. And I think Joan Didion said this actually about her. You know, they're the quick pronouncements of the kitchen. She's your brilliant friend who sits there and sometimes says stuff and it sounds brilliant. And then if you think about it later, you're like, well, yeah, I mean, that's a bit much, but okay. But you're with her, and it's exciting, and she's making you feel and react.
Well, what better recommendation can there be than that? Thea Leonarduzzi! Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Most of the women who have ever lived left no trace of their existence on the record of history. So says Susanna Lipscomb at the beginning of a new essay in which she tries to uncover traces in the records of the Protestant consistory courts of 16th century France. There, crimes of immorality were tried and punished using a sort of naming and shaming approach. And surprisingly, women appeared regularly in such a forum, what with their historical responsibility for all sexual impropriety and all that. A simple equation resulted, which has been multiplied ever since. Controlling morals meant controlling women. But unintentionally, consistory courts also became a place where women's voices at least had to be heard, even as a forerunner of modern-day self-protecting whisper networks. Lipscomb notes that women quickly learnt how to use the consistory. They denounced those who abused them. They deployed the consistory to force men to honour marriage promises. And they started rumours they knew would be followed up by the elders.
She tells the rather sad story of Magdalene Sermier, a source of consternation to the community, not only because she had the temerity to attend mass and to dance, but more seriously because she wouldn't marry her fiancé. She did not wish to submit because he was a beater, a man violently unsettled because his putative wife did not fear him. Magdalene didn't seem to fear the court either, as she was willing to apologise for her faith and her treacherously dancing feet, but not her sense of independence. Whether or not the story ended happily, alas, we cannot say, but Susanna, who's writing a book based on these court papers, can tell us more. She joins Thea and me now. Susanna, welcome.
Hello, thank you, yes.
Tell us about these courts, these consistory courts. What were they? What was their historical context?
Okay, so the context is 16th century France, where about when the 1550s and 1560s, particularly, people across the kind of swathes of the south of France, particularly, converted to Protestantism, Calvinism, Huguenotism, whatever, all these words are interchangeable. Although subsequently, especially after the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, many people who had converted, for example, in Toulouse, apostatized and became Catholic again, in certain towns like Nîmes on Montauban and certain villages in the Cévennes, people stayed convinced of their Protestant faith. And where they were the majority in a town, these consistory courts, if court is not quite the right word, but it's the closest we've got, were established by the church in order to police morality. So they would set up, in Nîmes, for example, they set up between 17 and 18 men met more than once a week, and they examined every bit of gossip, every rumour, every suggestion of impropriety. And they policed a number of streets and then would report all this back and then call in the offenders.
And do you think that because they were Protestants in a predominantly Catholic country in the middle of the wars of religion, they became more zealous because they were almost an endangered species, so that the issue of this type of enforcement became more important to them?
Yes, absolutely, for that reason. I mean, some of the time when this is happening, they are literally surrounded by Catholic forces. So, you know, if you're a Protestant going outside a city like Nîmes, you could actually die. But also, there is a mental attitude which suggests that if they can only achieve a pure city, if they can only adhere to a strict moral code, then they will please God, they will save themselves from his wrath, and this moral policing will bring them safety and victory in the war. So there's an extra sort of added reason to do it.
In that sense there, then, and different to the contemporary criminal courts, it's kind of based on a confessional process, isn't it?
Yes, they have what seems to us a sort of fairly naive expectation that if they ask them to tell the truth, that people will tell the truth. And if faced with a difficult situation, you know, he said, she said, they put the two people opposite each other and think, well, surely we're going to get the truth this way. But the thing is, of course, actually, people do confess. One of the interesting things about it, of course, is the extent to which some people in the community really are internalising the church's standards, and that's why they're denouncing other people. Some people come and confess and bring themselves to the consistory to say, I've done this thing wrong. And what's also interesting is that the way that they are punished is through this series of shaming punishments. Either you have to kneel down before the consistory and say, I've done this wrong, or you have to kneel down before the whole congregation on a Sunday admit your fault.
Was that really that bad? You know, this is a sort of time where people, you know, had their ears nailed to things and such like. Having to kneel down and say you did something doesn't feel terribly bad, but was it regarded as something horrific?
Yeah, so two things to say to that. One is, it was bad. If you think about the way in which people have been shamed in recent years, you know, there have been incidents of people being shamed because of their sexuality on social media and things like that. This is the early modern equivalent. So shame is much, much more terrible an experience to go through than I think we realise. And being shamed in front of your whole community for something that the whole community thinks is shameful is really sort of psychologically scarring. And in fact, one of the punishments that the criminal and civic authorities use at this time is precisely the same shaming thing, where you have to kneel down in front of people holding a torch in your hand. It's called the amende honorable. And in fact, it's before, you know, the famous attempted assassin Damien is brutally executed, he has to do this. But also there's a second thing, which is that actually there is a very close link between what's happening in the church and what's happening in the town. So I've seen, last summer I was looking at two things, one at the town council records in Nîmes, where I could establish that of those on the town council, 48% of them are also serving as elders on the consistory. And of the consuls, so those who really run the town, the in charge of the town, 65% of them are also elders. So there's a total overlap.
So this is a theocracy.
And, yes, it's a theocracy. And in Montauban, there's an amazing survival of criminal registers between 1534 and 1616. And looking at those, we see people who are being both punished or by the consistory and being punished by the consuls. So they're working hand in glove. And so just because you just had a shaming punishment in one place didn't mean you got away with something else in front of the town authorities.
These would, at one blush, seem to look at be a sort of system that would oppress women, because it's generally blokes who are sort of slightly appalled by the notion of women doing anything, it strikes me. But do you feel that they became subverted, at least by women, to a certain extent?
Yeah, so the first thing, absolutely, they are designed, this is a patriarchy, these are designed to control women who are, as you said, responsible for sexual sin. It's absolutely thought to be really squarely in the woman's camp, barring the fact that you obviously need two people. It's very much aimed at controlling women. But what's so extraordinary about it is that it reveals precisely how women, both using the consistory and using other strategies and devices available to them, try nevertheless to resist what is being imposed on them. They start to use the consistory for their own ends. They start to use the court of public opinion for their own ends. And So the irony is it reveals to us something that not many sources have revealed, which is this extraordinary, vocal, persuasive, bold power that women have. And one of the things that I think is really interesting about this is because up until now we've talked about the fact that, oh, yes, women in the past in these oppressed societies, yeah, but they had a kind of silent, devious sort of power. You know, there's that line from My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which says, you know, the man is the head of the family, but the woman is the neck. You know, she turns him whichever way she wants. But actually, what I'm seeing is it's not just that. We actually, in this society where women have no legal power, they have no rights under law, you know, they once they're married, they can't really own anything, all of that. But they're still demonstrating absolute power in their society to an extent, much more than we'd thought, I think.
So tell us then about the story of Magdalene, because that's representative, really.
Yes. So Magdalene is a woman who wants to marry after her own heart, or not marry in this case. And this is interesting because at the time, most women saw marriage, we would have thought, as the sort of ultimate horizon, because for them, marriage would be the key to having a happy life and being able to establish a kind of economic situation which they could work, all of this sort of stuff. But what is extraordinary about Madeleine is that she is someone who decides to go against this point of view. And she does so on the basis of what she considers to be a justified reason. She's called up because she has been accused of dancing and idolatry, attending the mass, but she is told that she has to marry her fiancé, and she just sort of doesn't respond. She keeps not responding and doing what she's told to do. When they say, you've got to submit to our authority, you know, the censure of the church, she says, oh, I don't really know what I'd be submitting myself to. So she's being bullshit, right? And then eventually she turns up and says, okay, she'll do what they tell her to do, but as far as this man that she's supposed to marry is concerned, she doesn't want to marry him, and she's not going to because God doesn't want it, which is which is just an amazing attempt to try and use the power that the consistory very much...
It's an unprovable argument, isn't it? Yeah. You can't prove it wrong, can you, I suppose?
Exactly. Although the consistory, you know, seem to think that they've got the kind of edge when it comes to hearing God's voice.
Yeah.
And they say this is blasphemy, and they suspend her from the Eucharist, which is the kind of central... participatory rite of this church, and they say that she has a rebellious heart, but she never in the sources that we have agrees to marry him. She keeps saying no, and then unfortunately we don't have any.
So what happened to her? What happened to her? Because if you're effectively, is this excommunicated more or less, if that's what
She's suspended, which is kind of the stage before excommunication. Excommunication is a permanent suspension, but it's the effectively, because she is not, if you're suspended from the Eucharist, you're not supposed to have social and economic interchange with the faithful. So, it's a massive deal.
So what would have happened to her? She'd be shunned, is this story likely to have ended happily or not?
It's not likely to have ended happily. We don't know. I mean, maybe she moved somewhere else in search of work. I don't know what happened to her, because these women appear on stage, as it were, dance before me, and then the records fall silent, and off they go off stage, and I have no idea what happens. But as you said in the introduction, she has some really good reasons not to marry him, because he's someone who has been beating her, and it's completely justifiable. But I do have an instance it's quite a sad story, but I do have an instance to answer the question of what happens to these women when they don't do what they're told.
Yeah.
There's a woman called Catherine Formentine who in 1579 in Nîmes is told that she has to marry this man called Captain Serre. She says she doesn't want to marry him. She wants to marry a man called Verdier, and the consistory say, no, you've got to marry the man your father says you're going to marry. So she is suspended from the sacrament, like Magdalene. Years pass, and she turns up three times to say she wants to be readmitted to the church, and they say, you're going to do what we say? And she says no, and they say, nope, off with you. And eventually it turns out that the man that she wants to marry is a Catholic, and so she says, well, if he had been a Protestant, I would have wanted to marry no other man but him, but as he's not, I'm not going to marry either one of them. But what's really interesting about this, and this is not a happy ending.
Oh God! This was starting to go so well. I thought, great.
I know. She's being. It's sort of so determined and bold. Well, you can judge it as you see.
Yeah, come on, out with it. Come on.
A few years later, she appears in the records because a young girl in the suburbs has said that she is pregnant by this man called Clauzon, who's this terrible womanizer and leading man in the town, and says that Catherine Formentine was the reason she'd fallen into such misfortune. A few years after that, another girl called Marie said that she had been Catherine's servant for 3 years and was persuaded by Catherine to abandon herself to sexual sin. With three men, and that she'd seen another girl come to Catherine's house to have sex with somebody. In other words, Catherine set up a brothel. There are attempts later, by 1613, to try and exile her from the town because of her involvement in.
But she presumably had no choice, because she had to make money however she could.
Yes, there was no other way for her to make money. This is precisely it.
She's an entrepreneur.
She's an entrepreneur, yeah. As it so happens, she sees a need and she sets up an industry.
It shows the power that this community had. Susanna, thank you so much for sharing those stories with us. When's the book out with all these stories contained in them?
Oh, I should think, unfortunately, in about a year's time or so. It's just going into the publisher at the moment. So,
have you finished it?
Not quite. Yes, it's due at the end of this month.
Okay, you better go back to finishing it. Susanna Lipscomb, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
There's a great piece of linguistic information in this piece, which I like. A surviving register of criminal sentences for Montauban shows cases of paillardise.
Oh.
Fornication
in
from
the
French paille for hay, as in rolling in the
rolling
hay. Isn't that nice? That's a universal metaphor for sex.
It's lovely.
I find that sort of thing really, really neat.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Publishing a volume of verse, the author and humorist Don Marquis lamented, is like dropping a rose petal down the Grand Canyon and waiting for the echo. For years, publishing a poetry pamphlet, the volume's slighter, nimbler sister, seemed as futile. Though sensing a butt in that opener from Leif Arbuthnot's majestic summary of recent poetry pamphlets, we'll not be disappointed. Publishing poetry pamphlets is decidedly no longer futile. Nor was it ever, of course. Because while it may not, indeed never has, translated to dizzying mountains of wealth, the form does have a history of launching the careers of some of our greatest poets. Before Seamus Heaney's Death of a Naturalist in 1966, for example, was a slim little thing called simply 11 Poems. Poetry pamphlets are, in that sense, brought to us from the coalface of talent, new and established, and we give them due recognition in this week's TLS, just a matter of days before the winners of the Michael Marks Awards for Poetry Pamphlets, in association with the TLS, the Wordsworth Trust and Harvard University, are announced. Leif Arbuthnot, a regular to our pages and one of this year's judges for the prizes, joins us in the studio now to tell us what those rose petals sound like and smell like when they land. Hello, Leif.
Hello. What an introduction.
I know. I mean, I think you're going to have to kick things off by telling us what a poetry pamphlet is and why I'm talking about smell.
Oh, yes. So typically a poetry pamphlet...
I just thought you'd gone mad.
Exactly. Well, I thought I needed to make sure someone cleared that up.
No, I will clear both of these things up. So poetry pamphlets tend to be quite short collections of poetry. So if we're talking usually around, it can be anything from sort of 3 pages to about 36 pages. The Michael Marks Awards, which kind of recognises poetry pamphlets, that they stipulate that they have to be under 36 pages, which just means that they got to be pretty short and pretty light. But apart from that, that the pamphlet kind of format is pretty broad. So we were talking about smell. One of the pamphlets that I was looking at earlier this year, or this autumn, in fact, was an extraordinary sort of box. It's called Five Charms for the Pottinger by Rebecca Sharp, and it's this black box, and there's a ribbon on the outside. You have to take the ribbon off, and then inside are five tiny little bottles of essential oils, and each of the bottles of essential oils corresponds with a different poem in the box as well, in another sort of envelope. So and the idea is that you kind of open the essential oil and you sniff it when you are reading the poem, so that there's
and
a
do
kind
you like
of,
that is that good does, I mean yeah, do you sit work? There and go gimmicky
I
can think
quite
of the poetry editor
it.
Of the TLS going gimmicky.
Yeah, I think that the poetry in this case wasn't that good. It was quite good, but it wasn't memorable. So I did think gimmick. But I also thought, this is fun. You know, wow. I would love to receive this as a present. And it was hard. It was so charming and so completely memorable and unexpected that I was won over in the end. Even if as a poetry critic, I wasn't that convinced. I'd also, you know, I'd been reading so many pamphlets that this one kind of stood out.
Yeah, it's nice.
What it does get to in doing that, though, is to kind of show us the extent to which all of this is the pamphlet form is, as you put it, a laboratory for experiments.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, the little bottles, you know, actually look like lab things anyway. So, and that's not the only kind of innovative amongst all of these pamphlets that I was looking at. There were other things which were really kind of pushing at the boundaries of what we envisage when the word pamphlet is used. So there was one which is the kind of main photo in the piece of this strange little pamphlet, I suppose, called Wave Motion. And you sort of hold it, and then the poems, there are two sort of sonnets, they sort of cascade out, and it's a bit like a kind of maybe a an, you know, one of these arty books you might pick up in a very hip shop in Shoreditch. But the poetry in this case was really excellent about, you know, rubbish in the sea and how, you know, standing in water in modern seawater is no longer quite as kind of beautiful as it used to be because you have flakes of plastic that are kind of wrapping themselves around your legs. So it's not all... It's not all gimmicks, and actually, obviously, the vast majority of the pamphlets that I've been reading recently are very, you know, recognisably book-like. They have either staples or they're properly bound if they're, you know, from a really posh publisher that's kind of putting a bit more money behind these things.
Has the role of the pamphlet sort of trying things out, testing things out, how's that not been taken by the internet, or has it been taken by the internet, where people can write something, push it out there with minimal expense, no overheads, and do that testing process without the need to get into publication at all?
I would say that there's room for both, and that both are doing that. So in pamphlets, you've got some people who are, you know, internet or they're sort of young people. They're known through for their slam poetry. For instance, Jamal Mehmood, who's a slam poet and who probably, you know, he's known via those like social media as well. So people like that are kind of taking their internet, you know, notoriety or something more positive, their fame on the internet, and then kind of investigating a more, you know, the print form. So I think that there's no need to kind of choose and say like, oh well, pamphlets are now irrelevant because we've got blogs. I think that there's room for
both. Validate it more. I always wonder with these things that there's something about something becoming physical rather than electronic. It feels it lends a certain validation.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Is that still true? Is that just I'm an old fuddy-duddy now at the
no,
age of 37.
I think you're right. I mean, I've noticed that the sort of excitement with which you know, particularly young poets greet the first publication of their pamphlet. It's and as they should, because it's so different from uploading something onto your website and not really knowing who's reading it, whether it's being appreciated. Okay, you can have a comment section where your mum will say that she loves your poems, but there is something that taps into, I think, something quite deep in us when you're holding a physical, you know, manifestation of your inward like creation, which is not the same as you know, scrolling on your screen. But I'm anti poetry snobbery. I think that some people don't like to read poems on the internet or on their screens. Some people do, and it's annoying when people say, oh, we should only ever read poems by the fireside, you know, in comfortable socks and with a pipe. So
although that is nice as well.
That is lovely. I'm not going to slam that.
The virtue of the pamphlet has always been really its cheapness to produce.
Yeah.
That's part of what's made it so vital. So do you get the feeling, because I know that the Michael Marks, and I should say I've judged the Michael Marks before, so I know that I know sort of what it entails.
Yeah.
And I know that you see every year the same publishers again and again.
Yeah.
You know, Carcanet, Mariscat, Flair Sachs. Do you get the sense that it is a really vital area of publishing now? Are there new people coming to the table and saying we want to publish this?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you know, I was struck by, well, firstly, the fact that there were some publishers there that I'd never heard of. And, you know, I mean, I'm not saying I know everything about poetry publishers, but, you know, there were one or two that I was like, oh, gosh, you know, this is a fantastic, that they've really discovered this amazing poet, and I'm so grateful for their work. There were also some self-published pamphlets, which I thought some of them were real, you know, were not good, you know, poems, and clearly they'd maybe tried to find a publisher and hadn't found one for maybe a good reason. But a lot of it was well, not a lot of it, but quite a few were self-published. So I'd say that it's still definitely it still provides an opportunity for writers who haven't found kind of success through the normal, you know, kind of paths to kind of reach an audience and a readership. But I think also something about the fact that the poetry pamphlet is quite cheap means that it's slightly more welcoming. It's less of an intimidating first step. You get poets who are writing pamphlets who have an enormous talent, but they're not necessarily, you know, that well known. They haven't got their poems into Rialto and Ambit and, you know, or like, you know, lots of other kind of amazing poetry sort of platforms. And so I think that it's a good sort of first step. But that sounds a little condescending, because I think also that the pamphlet itself is often so much more exciting than a collection, which can feel doughy and like, oh, I've got like 50 more pages of poetry to read. These are buzzy, and they're often kind of like a bit of a slap in the face if that's what the sort of content is like. They're really particularly good at carrying one sort of experience forward, or one, a narration about illness. Or so, for instance, we've got the Parkinson's poems by Frank Ormsby, which was a beautiful, very short pamphlet about his experience having Parkinson's, having been diagnosed in 2011. And the poems are literally just about what it's like to be diagnosed with Parkinson's and feel your body degenerating, and it's really moving. And then some other kind of pamphlets as well that similarly just basically focus on one thing, and they do it beautifully and kind of succinctly.
So who else is good? I mean, it's good because you've read an inordinate amount.
Well, 130 submissions, we should
more
say.
Than, yeah.
More than, yeah. 130.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's actually a really good test, this.
Yeah.
When you're reading a lot of poetry.
Yeah.
What lingers in your mind? What gets the hooks in?
Yeah, well, I think that probably the one that made me cry, which I think is actually a decent measure of like the skill of a poet, was a wonderful pamphlet called Career and Accompaniment by Alex Reed. And this was, he's really not a well-known poet at all, so I wasn't, not that I build up expectations, but it did slightly take me by surprise. And this was, I'm afraid, a sort of a weepy, a pamphlet about the experience of caring for his dying wife, and casting ahead while she was still ill into their future, which had been completely altered by the present illness, and then a few poems about what it was like afterwards, and it was such restrained poetry, none of that kind of splashy, all caps, all bold, all italics sadness. It was just very, very moving. So that was probably my one of my standouts.
Do you like restraint in poetry? Is that something that you look for? Because it's easy to, particularly when you read a right range, I suppose, of modern poetry, it's easy to see lots of tricks in it that can, I don't know, maybe it's just me, that can be a bit off-putting. Do you like to hear a natural voice in a poem?
It's interesting. So I think that restraint I generally like, though I like a varied diet in my poetry. Sometimes I want luscious, really flowery poetry occasionally, but what I really don't like is not always, but I often find that poetry that's extremely cold and brittle and maybe so disjointed that it looks like sort of random bits of words on a page, that sort of poetry really tests my patience. And I know it's fashionable, and I know I sound like a sort of old fuddy-duddy for sort of not thinking that poetry is good, but I often think of my mum, who is she's well read, but she's not a massive poetry fan. And I know that if I gave her one of these very modern poems that looks like sort of splintered glass, she would say, oh God, how pretentious. And so she sort of lingers in my mind like a sort of gremlin.
It should tell a story then.
Yeah, it should. And it should, I think if you're not sort of informing, for instance, there are some poems which are excellent at, or collections which are wonderful at kind of giving a sense of a community. Say, for instance, there's this the Swansea Love Song, which was wonderful.
I think I'm going to make you read that out.
Oh my gosh! Okay, we'll do. I'll do what I can.
Go on, where's the Swansea Love Song?
This is a Stephen Knight pamphlet.
Yeah, it was pretty extraordinary. But that kind of gives you that. Well, we'll talk about it, but
go on, read it out.
Okay, just for to kind of bracket what I'm about to read. Stephen Knight has a pamphlet.
Do you do a Welsh accent?
I really, really don't. Okay. See glonna prom screeching a said doff like Bonnie Tyler.
And the translation of that is in English.
Okay, seagull on the prom, screeching his head off like Bonnie Tyler. Now, so I would say that this doesn't suit podcasting, because the whole joy of this pamphlet is to see these completely nonsensical letters in combination, and then you read it aloud, and then you kind of get closer to the meaning. So actually, me reading it aloud straight away doesn't, it's not as funny. I mean, obviously, because you don't
it's
have
quite
that
funny,
kind of.
I found the way it became Scottish. British about halfway through to be.
Good. Well, I'm glad. I am now blushing. Yeah. Listeners.
The cruel but essential point of that was to show that it so much of these pamphlets are about linguistic play and about translation from one language to the other to another. A lot of the pamphlets are about dialect and playing with that. There was dual identities, aren't they?
There was a very, very good pamphlet by Yvonne Reddick, and this pamphlet has won lots of, you know, kind of, has got lots of attention already, called Translating Mountains, which was about the disappearance and then death of her father, who died in the Highlands. She tries to kind of include lots of Gaelic in her poems, and partly that sort of does go some way into capturing her sense of alienation, dislocation, and just, you know, loss following the death of her dad. And I thought that those poems worked really well. And there was a wonderful poem about how she's lost when trying to use Gaelic words, but she's just as lost when she's in London trying to negotiate Arnold's Grove and Gospel Oak, and that kind of disorientation she feels in the city, which is of course a universal theme, very modern, but beautifully handled by her.
We've got to leave it there, but I want to just to finish with a quote that you give. Oliver Jones's collection, which I think is called Chronic Youth, is that right?
Yeah.
Advice is the poem, and you say it has four sparkling lines of guidance that are begging to be memorised. So here they are. If you can, sleep. Sleep immediately and deliciously with all your clothes on.
Yep, it's great advice.
Yeah, poetry you can use.
Exactly. Get it tattooed onto your hand.
Yeah.
Well, we do have to end it there.
Yeah.
sadly,
go for a kit.
And we can't. We exactly all of us with our clothes on. We can't end by asking you to pick your favourite, because that would kill the suspense. Everyone has to wait until the 12th of December, and then we'll find out who has won. So thank you very much, Lee, for joining us.
My pleasure.
The Michael Marks Awards for the best pamphlet, publisher, and illustration. So that's three awards. Will be announced on the 12th of December at the British Library.
And that's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Leif Arbuthnot and Susanna Lipscomb. My thanks go to feudal landlady Thea Lenarduzzi. Do go to the-tls.co.uk or your local shop for this week's edition of the TLS, which has lots on Renaissance literature, plus stuff on Bob Dylan, trees and samurais. You won't get all that in the NYRB. Next week, we may turn our minds to Darwin and the Reformation, or we may turn our minds to something else entirely. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.